So thank you for giving me the podium here. This is work on behalf of Lindsay America Sims, who recently graduated from Guelph, and Andrew Ross, sitting over here. I encourage you to think of the hard questions for Andrew. And this is work drawing from a bigger agenda, as Ian mentioned, but in particular John Cranfield in food, agriculture, and resource economics here has contributed much of the work from which this is coming in some sense. This will be largely quantitative. Think of it as the view from 35,000 feet. So we're looking for systematic patterns, big things, without necessarily understanding them very well. And in fact, I would say to understand them, in the end, we will need exactly the kind of studies that we've heard all day today. This is what's going to allow us to understand bigger patterns. My job, in part, is to ensure that we don't get misled by false patterns, by seeing something in the data that, in fact, might be misleading us. This is an attempt to say something about how BMI changed, so body mass index, a measure of obesity, before 1950, the first half of the 20th century. We have lots of data that tell us what has happened since 1970, and well-known, well-studied in Canada as elsewhere. We know BMI is increasing substantially everywhere. We also know, it's not as widely recognized, but Canada had a very good height and nationally representative height and weight survey in 1953 that actually does allow us to say pretty well what's happening through the 50s and 60s and 70s. So essentially the second half of the 20th century is very well documented at a kind of macro level. And of course, the story is one of increasing obesity. There's some research in other countries that would suggest that this pattern began earlier, that it's a longer process. And of course, as historians, we would suspect that probably it did go back further. And that was the premise on which I submitted an abstract here. And it has been a surprise to me, in fact, that I'm not sure we do see evidence of this in Canada. So if anything I say sounds confused, it's because genuinely I am confused. These numbers came forward very recently in the last few days, and they're not what I expected. So I'm hoping you will be able to help me figure them out. So very broadly, the kinds of research on obesity, one is what are the health consequences? Lots of scientific studies here, a mountain of them. From a social science and historical perspective, what are the cross-sectional correlates of obesity? How do we understand people's consumption, people's exercise pattern, essentially behavioral analysis? Again, a big genre of that. And related to that, how can authorities concerned with public health manipulate what we eat, how we exercise? What policy levers are there? There's also a smaller literature to which this paper contributes on the longer-term changes. So this is getting the big picture, in a sense, over a longer stretch. It may not say very much about policy. It may not help us fix health tomorrow. But it is useful, and indeed, as historians, we do want to know this. So the specific questions here, what are the long-term Canadian patterns for obesity, but BMI in particular, I will use. Are there compositional effects? Are there different parts of the population at different times that have different kinds of experience? And broadly, why does it matter? I'm getting at this through using some of the very few sources that give medical exams systematically to large numbers of people before 1950. And it turns out that we have two world wars, 1914 to 1918, 1939 to 1945, in which large numbers of Canadian men and women enlisted. I'm going to talk only about the men, largely because I don't have enough women in the sample to do very much with. These records, I'll show you an example in a second. Many of you have seen these records. Are sampled in a particular way. The sample was drawn with everyone whose name began with B, essentially, was the sampling method, which is, in fact, drawn from a strategy adopted by some demographic historians who looked at Montreal intensively. So Thornton and Olson in Montreal, this was their strategy, and I think it's a good one. So we have lots of men who served in World War I, and we know their height and weight, and some other things about them. World War II, these records are not public, so here the selection is, again, B surnames, and because there aren't so many of them, then going to the next largest letter, M, and or we're still, I think we're on S now. They had to have died in the war, because those who died, their records are publicly accessible in the archives, so you can get at them. Now, you can worry about the people who died. Are they the same as people who didn't die? That's going to be a question. Here, we're only looking at records that have an identifiable height, weight, and age, and birthplace and birth date. And the filtering of the data, we throw out some of the outliers, too. So if somebody says they're 9 feet tall, we don't believe them. We allow them to be 8 feet tall, but we don't allow them to be 9 feet tall. Or up to 7'11", I think, is our cutoff. So what we're doing is trying to characterize the population. This is not the kind of research that says anything useful about individuals. So one looks at individuals and say, oh, look at that, 7'11". But in general, it's the patterns, it's the averages that are going to matter. It's coming from a conceptual world in which we study anthropometric characteristics, height, weight, other characteristics, in order to infer something about living conditions. And so, and it's clearly an indirect way to get at living conditions, but it's a way to get at living conditions in circumstances where we just don't have other data. That's why we do it. And there's a well-developed framework that really began with physical anthropologists and has now moved into economics and history, in which we think that our stature as adults is essentially determined by, in part, our genetic inheritance and, in part, the circumstances in which we lived as children. And geneticists like to think it's 80-20. 80% the genes and 20%. So what we're looking at is trying to infer something about that 20% variation in adult stature in order to then cast back and say, well, when people were children, they had good living conditions, bad living conditions. That explains what happened in this 20% of variation in adult stature. Because it's all casting backwards to childhood experience, you have to organize the data, and in your mind, you have to think about experience as children. So the evidence comes in 1914, but you're really understanding, you're trying to understand living conditions in 1890. So you organize by birth cohort, organize by birthplace. It's very different than studying BMI and weight, because we know that our weight varies year to year. If we go out and exercise a lot, our weight will fall. So in fact, consumption and activity in the last year or 2 years effectively are determinants of weight and BMI. So it's very different. One of the complications that has snuck up on me is that BMI actually includes height in it. So it's weight adjusted for height. So in fact, you have to think about both of these kinds of frameworks, both the what we call period effects. So what people were doing in 1912 and 1913 before they got measured in 1914, That will tell you about their weight, but their height, that's what happened when they were growing up in 1890. So you need both of those to be there. So that's the kind of methodological framework here. There are, of course, big questions here about what we can say beyond the particular records we're looking at. Can we infer from this sample to the Canadian population? And at this point, I would not try to do that. We're looking at men who served in these two wars and trying to say something about them, and we will try to think about who actually served in the war, and there'll be some of that kind of logic, but in the end, that's just enough. That's a big topic, and we're not there yet in terms of understanding this. This is a First World War enlistment paper, front and back. Some of you will have seen them. This one, in fact, is a good one because on the back, if you can't see, you can move forward here. I'll be using lots of slides here. In fact, weight is not given here on this enlistment form. So it's one of the ironies. These enlistment forms have been scanned or all online at the archives. Very helpful. But if you want weight for 5/6 of the records, you must go to Ottawa and look at the paper files. So that's been done, in fact. In fact, is a student at the Ontario Agricultural College, born in Eastern Ontario. Exactly what he was doing at the age of 26 here at OAC and at the outbreak of war, we don't know that. This is a World War II form, and these, of course, must be seen in Ottawa, in the archives. You're pulling personnel files, and they're big, thick, dusty things. Some of them have mold on them, and so we don't report on the ones with mold. And as in the World War I records, in order to get some of the medical detail, you have to go to other documents in the file. But these files are pretty rich, and you do find other documents. So this is a World War II. So anyone interested in hearing or vision disabilities, these are great sources here. They're documenting teeth, eyes, hearing, and so on. So one question is, who is in these samples? And are they comparable? If we're going to compare the enlistment in two wars, are they comparable? The simple way to start is by just looking at the age composition, and this revealed a surprise right away, that there were a lot more 18 to 20-year-olds in World War II than in World War I, which maybe other people know this. I had no idea. It is possible, of course, that the younger ones were the ones who died early in the war. There could be selection like this. We don't know. It's also apparent that there is a greater enlistment by older guys in World War I. And I think it's worth having the general context here that World War I was a pretty enthusiastic enlistment in most parts of Canada, and there were lots of people who just really wanted to go out and serve their king, as it was then. There's considerable enthusiasm, and including being older. So you might think that the married guy 40 years old would not be first in line to enlist, but in fact, some of them were. Birthplace composition here is also interesting. Canada's quite unique in the British Empire, actually. So this kind of research I'm doing in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and Britain as well. Nearly half the army was born outside Canada. Not entirely surprising that it would be a big proportion. The very major wave of immigration between 1895 and 1913 brought a lot of young men to Canada. And that wave of immigration was less family-based and more young men than earlier waves of immigration. And so that's not surprising, but that it's quite so many from the rest of the world is surprising to me. Of course, many of these immigrants are from Britain. This is a war in which enlisting in the Canadian Army it's almost like enlisting in the British Army. Not quite. Some people did transfer once they were shipped to England. The proportion is lower in World War II. The proportions within Canada, again, partly partly they reflect obvious demographic changes, and that's so the rise of the Western provinces. If you think of these cohorts, these are people born in World War I, born in the 1880s and 1890s. There weren't that many guys out there. By the 1920s, 19-teens and 20s, there were lots of people out there. So we would expect to see a rise in the Manitoba share, a rise in the Alberta and Saskatchewan share, et cetera. This is not surprising. It is a little bit unexpected, again, to me, that the Quebec share falls so much. And that is part of why I'm going to end up saying that some of the Quebec elements of this one should be careful about. It may be that enlistment in Quebec in World War II was on a slightly different basis than in World War I. I'm sure we'll come back to that. So the evidence on stature is kind of what we expect here from other sources. The blue and green lines are World War I enlistment. Purple and red are World War II. The Canadian ones are blue and red. We see declining stature in the World War I cohorts, rising in World War II cohorts, exactly as we would expect. That we know that stature in general in Canada was not increasing in the 19th century. People were getting taller over the decades, but they were in the 20th century. And the turning point is almost 1900, ironically. I mean, it needn't have been, but it is roughly so. So here's the evidence for BMI. And here's the surprise, that the World War II line is under the World War I line, consistently. It's just not at all what I expected. So the more will have to be said about this. So the first observations here, the stature stuff is pretty much what we'd expect. John Cranfield and I have published on this before. BMI is rising with age. So any analysis here is going to have to take account of age, since we know these two wars have a different age structure of the enlistment, and we know that BMI changes with age, so this you will have to adjust by age. And one way to do that is, you can't just do how tall were 22-year-olds in one war versus the other, but generalizing over the whole thing, over all ages, it's fitting a model that simply describes how BMI changes as people get older in cross-section here, with some adjustment for where you were born, so dummy variables for different birthplaces, and also for different occupations, too. And finally, just a simple dummy variable for World War I. And the fact that that's a positive number is saying that people on average had 2 to 3 points higher BMI in World War I, generalizing across the population and adjusting for age, as it's important to do. The adjustments for birthplace matter a lot. Every birthplace is statistically significantly different. Surprisingly to me, the adjustments for occupation are not significant. And that may be that we just haven't organized them properly yet. Doing it by region, again, reveals interesting differences where we do see a negative now. BMI is slightly lower in World War I in Quebec. So World War I to World War II, there is a rise in BMI. The rest of them, it's falling. In fact, in the Atlantic region and the West, it's falling by a lot. So how do we understand that? I think for Quebec, one needs to take a deep breath and worry about the enlistment. Is it the same slice of the population between the two wars? It could be. We don't have, it's not uncomfortable to think of the Atlantic region and the West as having a decline in BMI. If you think of the Great Depression, which hit particularly hard in Western Canada, you think of Atlantic Canada, which the Depression did not hit hard, but that's only because the 1920s were already very bad. So these are the parts of the country that probably people were in straitened circumstance more commonly. So this is the same evidence that I just showed you, but with a nice lime green. So in order to get at this, in the end, I think it's important to look at what's underlying the BMI, because it is this combination of weight and height, and I keep coming back to that as something to think about here. So what I'm doing is showing you average stature by region. This is not adjusted by age here across the country. And what we're seeing, the fact that the blue lines are all taller than the red lines, that's saying that people are getting taller in the 20th century. And in fact, a lot taller. This is a very fast rate of growth of stature, especially fast in Quebec. Of course, the Quebec population, the Quebec-born population, is the shortest in Canada by a considerable margin. And what part of what's happening here is that they're catching up. There's some tendency towards convergence. Now we're going to do weight. So this is the other element that goes into BMI. It's in the numerator now. And it's sort of the same pattern for some parts of this process, but not exactly. Most of the blue lines are taller than the yellow lines, but not all of them, in fact. The weight of an average soldier from Atlantic Canada diminished a little bit, say the same, more or less. The weight of a soldier born in Alberta, Saskatchewan, decreased even more. So that means, combined with that rising stature, the fact that weight is staying the same or declining a little bit in those regions, that's why we get the big decline in BMI. So the interaction of the two is part of what's going on here. We do see a big rise in weight in Quebec and the modest change in Ontario. If you take Ontario here, compare that to the height change. You don't want to compare just the absolute values here, because in the BMI expression, there's a nonlinear relationship, so it's not straightforward. But you can see that height is increasing faster than weight. And that's, in the end, why BMI is declining. So what do we think this all means? We think that the BMIs, the levels of BMI here, are all pretty low, in the range of 21, 22 for all of these groups. And there's no sign of a rise from World War I to World War II. Maybe an exception in Quebec, and there may be other subcomponents of the population that are exceptional, but we do our best adjustments, best to date, for age and occupation and birthplace. It doesn't change the picture. We are concerned about the representativity of the soldiers, of the evidence itself. Clearly, the Great Depression matters in this. I think it's a mistake to put too much weight on that, though. There was a very serious recession in 1913, just before World War I as well. The 1930s depression, in fact, was at its worst in 1932 and 33. By 1939, there had been substantial recovery. So people had got out of it. So if we're really looking at the last couple of years, we have as much to worry about with World War I as World War II. Another consideration here, part of what made the Great Depression so hard for Canada was that the price of food went through the floor. So food prices went way down everywhere, which of course should encourage people, for any income that you have, you can consume. So the Great Depression may matter. It may matter more in Atlantic Canada and in the West, but how important? Part of what I'm thinking about here is what this is telling me is that we've heard these arguments before, but we need to be careful about the use of BMI as a measure, because there are different processes affecting both the numerator and the denominator. A big part of the explanation for the rise in stature, almost certainly, is the various improvements in public health that we hear about in Quebec and elsewhere, pasteurization of milk, et cetera. I mean, all these kinds of things are allowing stature to become much greater in the population, even though people might be consuming the same things. In other ways, living the same kind of lives, same exercise, same. So that kind of stature increase might not imply anything for weight. That could give rise to stature increasing very quickly and weight not changing very much at all. And it's saying that if we're going to use BMI as an obesity measure, we perhaps need to broaden beyond this calories in, calories out framework in which we're looking at consumption and exercise or energy expenditure, and in this case, bring public health into the discussion, because that could be what's influencing some, at least some parts of this pattern. I think, yeah, that's it. So, thank you.